Figure skating couple has won every gold medal in pairs since 1964. Last night, the Chinese dethroned them. Shui Xin and Hongbo Zhao skated a nearly flawless program on a night when almost everyone slipped and fell on the ice at least once. They are veterans of the sport, having won bronze in Salt Lake City and in Torino. A Chinese pair also took second, with Germany taking the bronze. The men's individual figure skating events start tonight, with the women's and the ice dancing still to come. Diana Douglas, NPR News, Vancouver.
The weather is again causing problems for alpine skiers at the Vancouver Olympics. This time, heavy snow has forced the postponement of today's men's super combined race, and training runs for tomorrow's women's downhill have been canceled, giving American Lindsey Vonn more time to rest her injured shin. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Civic Ventures, presenting the Purpose Prize to people who solve major social problems in their encore careers. Nominations at purposeprize.org.
When we were at the Sweet Corn Festival, we brought health and wellness to the community. Everybody knows exercise is good for them, but if we can make it easier for people to be active, then they're more likely to do it. The goal of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District is to get the community well and keep the community healthy. We had been involved with WIL with the Healthy Habits program, but beyond that, we were kind of doing things separately in terms of, you know, educating the community, encouraging the community to do physical activity and learn about nutrition and change their eating habits. WIL initiated the process and invited everybody to the table. My name is Nikki Hillier. I'm with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, and WIL is my source for keeping Champaign-Urbana families healthy.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for another edition of our morning talk program. A little bit earlier this month, the Secretary of Defense of the United States, Robert Gates, and Admiral Mike Mullen, he's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, told members of Congress that they would be in favor of lifting the ban on gay men and lesbians serving openly in the military. Here's some of what Admiral Mullen had to say. He said, "Speaking for myself and myself only, it's my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do." He said, "No matter how I look at the issue, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens." He said, "For me personally, it comes down to integrity, theirs as individuals and ours as an institution." And while it might seem that public opinion among Americans tends to favor dropping this ban, that many in the military are opposed. And certainly these two men, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, are out ahead of Congress and the White House on this issue as well. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about the policy that is in place now, this policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, how we got to that, and about the potential for changing that and dropping the ban that prevents people from serving openly if they are gays or lesbians. And our guest for the program this morning is Dr. Nathaniel Frank. He is a senior research fellow at the Center, the Palm Center, at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And this is a think tank that's particularly interested in doing research on the subjects of gender, sexuality, and the military. He has written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, the New Republic, the LA Times, a number of others. He's also the author of a book which looks at this very issue that we're talking about here this morning. The title of his book is Unfriendly Fire: How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. That was published by St. Martin's Press in March of last year. And I'm sure that if you are interested in reading the book, you can find it in the bookstore or in the library. And as we talk here this morning, questions are always welcome. We like to involve people in the conversation. We do ask people to try to keep their comments brief, but you're certainly welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to join the conversation. Dr. Frank, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I'm sure at some point here we'll talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, why we have that policy, what happened when the last time this was a major topic of discussion back in 1993. But just to start, the point to make would be that at that time, it seemed that in the military there was very strong opposition to the idea of gays and lesbians serving openly. Colin Powell at the time was the head of the Joint Chiefs. He was opposed. The brass was opposed. So now we have the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs saying that they support lifting the ban. Why now?
Well, it's been 17 years since Don't Ask, Don't Tell was first implemented, and the world has changed enormously. One of the most important ways in which it's changed is that we have become a nation at war since 2001. And interestingly, the discharge figures under Don't Ask, Don't Tell have plummeted since we became a nation at war, and historically throughout the 20th century, that's what happens. And that kind of gives the lie to the idea that gay people undermine the military, because when commanders need cohesion most, they look the other way. They ignore this policy. They try to retain badly needed personnel. So we've lost under this policy 13,000 service members, and hundreds of them have been deemed mission critical by the U.S. government, including Arabic linguists. And I think this is a recognition that we can no longer afford to kick people out for something that has nothing to do with military performance.
Well, how... I would take Admiral Mullen at his word that he believes that this is the right thing to do, maybe on ethical, moral grounds, and that that is part of what motivates him. But it sounds as if you were saying that if this happens, that the primary reason would be that we're at a point now where we cannot afford to lose anybody, and anybody who is able to serve and willing to serve, we need those people.
Well, I think that's what these statements reflect, but no doubt this is a political issue. It's a controversial political and cultural issue, and so it also reflects what's going on in politics. We have a Democratic president who campaigned on this issue, not just sort of glibly the way Bill Clinton did, who thought this would be easy, but in President Obama's case, I think he really had looked into the issue. He had looked into the research and seen that there's no evidence showing that openly gay service undermines the military. So I think the politics also reflects the reality. But sure, we have a Democratic president, we have a Democratic Congress, and there has been a push to repeal this, and I think that's reflected too. But I think the idea that, you know, there's been a kind of talking point that pushback by the far right wing saying Admiral Mullen was only expressing his personal views. Well, those personal views mean that he has been persuaded by looking at this issue that this is, that it's time to lift the ban. So I don't think it's just on moral grounds that he thinks this. Those views reflect his understanding about what's good for the military, and that to compromise the institutional integrity and the personal integrity of tens of thousands of gay service members, as well as straight people, because they're being forced to be lied to. So he couched it in personal terms for important reasons. But this means he has been persuaded that it's time to do this and that that's good for the military.
And I suppose we shouldn't understate the significance of his very public statement on this there in front of members of Congress.
Absolutely. I think some of us were surprised by the passion of his remarks, and I think that's part of what angered Senator John McCain, who flip-flopped on his position, having previously said that when the Joint Chiefs, when the military comes to him and says it's time to do this, that he would seriously reconsider it. And instead, he began to lecture the military chiefs, saying he was disappointed in them, that they were trying to lift this by fiat. But Admiral Mullen's comments were poignant. I think they were pointed, and I think they were important in showing that the military is going to put its senior leadership behind this change. And the research shows that that's very important for a smooth transition.
Is there reason to believe that there are substantial numbers of gay people who would serve, would be willing, would be interested, but are, when they look at the ban on serving openly, they would say, I can't go in under those circumstances?
Well, yes, that common sense dictates that. When you have a population of people considering service because of the wide range of reasons that other people consider service, but they know that it has a tradition of being hostile to people who are a member of their group, then sure, they're going to think twice. That doesn't just go for gay people. It goes for straight people who find the military's stance up until now on this issue to be sort of out of touch with 21st century values. And there's also been research done on this out of the Williams Institute at UCLA, estimating that there would be thousands of new service members who would consider join or join because of the ban being lifted.
Mm-hmm. There have been a number of people who have made an appeal to President Obama to make this change and to do it by executive order. Do I understand that to mean that if he wanted to, if he chose to, he could do that?
That's right. This was a little-known option, and the Palm Center where I work actually outlined this option back in May of 2009 using his stop-loss authority, which is congressional authority given to him to regulate separations of military personnel during a time of war. He can suspend all discharges right away. And that's a controversial idea, and some people worry that that would, you know, echo some of what President Bush got into trouble doing, seeming like he was overriding the will of Congress. But in this case, it's actually quite different because this is a congressional law that says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the president can halt separations during a time of war. So that's something that he could do. He has not expressed that he's likely to do it. But I do think that the review that Secretary Gates announced at the hearings this month, saying that next month there will be a recommendation to modify enforcement of the policy, reflects that that fact that the executive branch and the Pentagon itself have latitude, as Secretary Gates said, to relax enforcement of this policy even before Congress repeals it.
Well, short of that action by the White House, then, would, to repeal the ban, would that require congressional action?
To fully get this law off the books, it would require Congress. Uh-huh. Congress passed a law in 1993. That was part of the fallout from the battle when Clinton tried to lift this in that year, in 1993. And so because it's a federal statute, Congress would have to repeal it. But you could have an effective repeal, that is, that you could effectively end the ban through executive action, even though it would still be on the books, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Let me very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour, Dr. Nathaniel Frank. He's a senior research fellow at the Palm Center, which is a think tank located at University of California at Santa Barbara, where they do research on the subjects of gender, sexuality, and the military. He has written quite a bit on the subject himself, including the recent book Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. And that book was published in 2009 by St. Martin's Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I know this is complicated, so if I just ask you to talk a little bit about Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the debate that took place in 93, but can you give us the thumbnail sketch of how the issue was discussed at that time and then how it is we ended up with this policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Sure. Well, there was some anger before the 1992 elections when it turned out that the Pentagon had sent known gays to the first Iraq War. And then when they had returned, they had often been discharged. And it seemed very hypocritical, and it seemed to suggest that the military itself didn't believe that gays undermined cohesion and that they were just clinging to this idea, kind of as a mark of their own traditional culture and identity, that the military was supposed to be free of homosexuality, even though that's never been the case. And I think that President Clinton, as a candidate, Bill Clinton, thought that it would be relatively easy to undo this policy, which it might have been had he issued an executive order from the beginning, rather than spending months debating and studying the issue, which is now, ironically, what it looks like we're poised to do as a nation again. But there was tremendous resistance, and I think he underestimated that resistance. And part of the outcome of the battle was that Congress got involved. And under Senator Sam Nunn and Bob Dole, they had threatened that if Clinton went forward to try to lift the ban, they would write the current ban into law permanently. Not permanently, but, to make it a congressional legislation would make it harder to undo, just as we're seeing right now. And that's, in fact, what happened. Even though Clinton did compromise and didn't lift the ban entirely, the outcome was that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy became both a Pentagon policy and a federal statute. And it says that anyone who says they're gay or engages in homosexual conduct or marries or attempts to marry someone of the same sex will be separated unless, you know, that's subject to certain exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the policy we have now.
What can you talk a little bit more about what sort of, I mean, there you have touched on them, but what sort of behavior would someone have to exhibit to qualify for being removed from the service because they were gay? I mean, what exactly does the policy say that you cannot do?
Well, the full name of the policy is Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. And then also the phrase Don't Harass was added to it around the year 2000. And so the idea was supposed to be they would drop the question on the application at recruitment of whether you're gay. And that was a nod to say, we know gays are serving, and so long as they keep it to themselves and don't allow their sexual orientation to be known and don't engage in any kind of sexual conduct, then we will let them continue to serve. So in some ways, the best thing that can be said about the policy is that its spirit was to try to make sexual orientation a non-issue and to try to allow discretion to prevail and stop kicking out gay people at such large numbers. But in fact, the opposite happened. The discharge figures went up, harassment went up, and there were pursuits. There were witch hunts. Third parties can bring evidence to commanders based on rumor, suspicion, or total untruth. And in fact, straight people have, in rare cases, actually been kicked out under the policy. So if you leave a letter out on your desk, if your emails or mail or phone calls are tapped into, which the military obviously does for national security reasons, if a civilian, out of vengeance or any number of reasons, brings your sexuality to the attention of a commander, an investigation can be discharged. And so these ended up in pursuits and witch hunts and many, many people being kicked out, even though they were doing their best to abide by the spirit of the policy, which was to not engage in conduct, to not have relationships, and to not go out and make statements. Now, in many cases, people do come out as a statement. So they may say or write a letter to their commander and say, I'm gay. In rare cases, that's because people are just trying to get out of service, but much more often it reflects the hostility and the fear that they face in, having their career always be at risk because of the possibility that in circumstances outside their control, they may be outed and discharged or punished.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I actually covered most of the area that my first question was about, so let me throw a couple of others. I guess I'd be interested in the, criticism of this position on the right. Somebody of a scientific taint is going to say, well, do you have data about under fire homosexuals with straights? Do they perform as well? Do they take the gun as well? You know, stuff like that. Has that ever been done? Because I'm sure somebody's going to bring that up. It would be nice to have evidence on one side or other of the fence. And the second thing is, in terms of gays themselves, since the early part of it, they were, anti-gay. I just wondered if there are people at higher levels who are gay, and do they have to come underneath this don't tell, don't, harass thing also? Never hear anything about, a general being gay or anything like that, so maybe it's even silly to think about it that way. But I thought about it the first time it came out, and I said, if I'm under fire and the next guy next to me is gay, I could care less as long as he knows how to shoot that damn gun. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, I think that's well said, and the short answer to both questions is yes. There are plenty of examples of gays in combat units, and there's never been any evidence showing that they perform less well. And there have been, example after example of gays performing valiantly, including in combat. And that's part of what I write about in my book, because there's a general understanding that gays have always served in the military. But then when people dig into the details, they sometimes wonder, are they in combat positions? Are they in leadership positions? And this is a question that is asked about the 25 foreign countries that already let gays serve. So part of what I do in the book, and in fact the Palm Center is coming out with the largest ever study on gays in foreign militaries. We'll probably be releasing that next week. And there are numerous examples of gays in the combat arms and at higher levels. The problem is that the policy makes such empirical research difficult because you can't ask someone if they're gay. And certainly being a general and being gay has happened. There are several generals who have retired from the military and came out over the past few years. But saying so when you're in the military would obviously be a career killer because of the policy. And, you know, even apart from the policy, there's concerns about promotion and so forth. But there are absolutely gays throughout the military at the highest levels and in combat arms, and they perform just like straights. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, and you talked earlier about the fact that actually during the time that we've been at war here now over the last few years, that the numbers of people being discharged because they were gay have actually gone down. And you could explain that in part by the need for soldiers and the fact that the military can't afford to lose anybody. But I think you would still have to believe that, particularly in combat, if there was someone who was not doing his or her job, they wouldn't keep that person just because they need the body.
Well, right, and there are all kinds of regulations, you know, and policies in place that call for separation of people if they are engaging in conduct, gay or straight, and I don't just mean sexual conduct, that is prejudicial to good order and discipline. There's a certain mm-hmm. amount of discretion that's given to commanders. There has to be. That's why they're, you know, in leadership positions. And I think people sometimes get concerned or confused when it comes to talking about, you know, gays and lesbians and talking about sexuality, that somehow there needs to be a whole new layer of regulations or a whole new layer of fears or concerns about what will happen. Gay people are by and large no different from straight people, and the regulations in place already in the military, including the Uniform Code of Military Justice, are there to make sure that conduct that is harmful to the military is not tolerated. But what the research shows, and what many of us have been saying for several years now, is that simply being gay or having a partner, you know, at home, off base, that you share your life with, has no bearing on the effectiveness of the military. And I think that's reflected by the commanders that you see, you know, throwing their hands up when they are told that they have to fire someone that is very valuable to them just because they're gay. They don't want to lose these guys.
Another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4 on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Was it the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who said that he was sad because people have to lie about their age in order to defend their country? Was that his statement?
No, he didn't say that they had to lie about their age. He said something. I mean, I can read it back to you again.
Lie about who they were.
He said, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens. That's what this was Admiral Mike Mullen. He's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
It seems to me that Admiral Mullen confused having to conform to a standard to dishonesty in trying to avoid that standard. About lying about someone's age, you know, there's a practice. It occurred often, still occurs, I guess, when men not old enough to enter the armed service will lie about their age to get into the army. Now, there is a minimum age. That minimum age is a standard. And when teenagers lie about their age in order to enter the service, nobody complains. Isn't it a shame that these young men have to lie about their age in order to defend their country? People think that we ought to conform to the standard that is set up in law to enter the armed services. I think the admiral is off base. May I say something about my own experience in the armed forces? As an Air Force officer, I saw records of homosexual molestations in the enlisted barracks. And so when I hear claims that homosexuality doesn't matter in the armed forces, I know better.
If I could respond to that, I think I understand the analogy that the caller is trying to make with age, which is that there are standards in the military that people have to conform to, and if you don't meet that standard and you have to lie in order to try to meet that standard, then what we really should be focusing on is the standard. I mean, that's at least the most generous way I can summarize what the caller is asking. I think what we're talking about here is a uniform standard for all people, and that what's really bad for the military is having one set of standards for one group of people and a different set of standards for another group of people, particularly when the research makes clear that that separate standard, that double standard, is not necessary. So that's the response to the question about standards. As far as homosexual molestation, you know, this is kind of the definition of prejudice, is that you take an example you've heard of someone who belongs to a category who's done something wrong, and you say, therefore, we must exclude the entire group of people, so that if Jews have stolen something, you should be able to exclude all Jews from the town center. I mean, that's not a way of implying, you know, empirical research to public policy. There is no reason to believe that gay people are any more inclined to engage in assault in the military than straight people. And when they are, there are codes in place to discipline them and punish them.
Yeah, but in the military, men fight because they love their comrades. It's called unit cohesion. I know we think that they fight for their country, and they do. They're patriotic. But they're fighting for that guy that's beside them in that foxhole. That's who they're really fighting for, and the men whom they want to respect them are the men in their unit. That unit when there's a homosexual molestation, if that doesn't destroy that unit cohesion, nothing will.
I absolutely agreed. When there is any kind of misbehavior, that person is punished, and in that case will be thrown in jail. There is, believe me, far more of a problem with heterosexual molestation than homosexual molestation, and even though in most cases men and women are not being housed together, increasingly those lines are blurred on the front lines of these guerrilla wars, and you know, you don't have that kind of privacy. So you have the same concern, and it's a much bigger problem just because of the numbers with heterosexuality. So I certainly agree with you about unit cohesion. I've written widely about unit cohesion. But this is a different world from, you know, the mid and early 20th century, and there's simply no research to show that men in combat automatically dislike or hate homosexuals so much that they won't fight for them. There are countless examples of a new reality on the ground of gay and straight men being comrades, being friends, being buddies. And so this old idea that, you know, you absolutely have to keep all gay people out because straight people won't fight for a gay buddy, it's just not true anymore.
And this is, I want to thank the caller and invite some other folks into the conversation here. But this is, and he raises the point that one sees over and over and over again, that is the chief reason for opposing lifting the ban, this thing called unit cohesion. So you feel confident that there's more than anecdotal evidence to show that straight soldiers have no problem serving alongside, fighting with comrades that might be gay?
Well, first of all, this is already the case. Two-thirds of service members already believe that there are gays in their units. So this is not a social change. This is not anything new. This is about the rhetoric of the policy coming into conformity with the reality that everybody, that every serious observer already knows is the case. So by keeping gays closeted, you do nothing to prevent misbehavior. This is about admitting that gays are already there. And when you bring it to the surface, you're in a much better position to punish people who are doing something wrong. But you don't have to take my word for it. I mean, this is what military studies have now begun to say, that there's no evidence at all, and never has been, that gay people undermine the military. They've always been there. And we as a culture need to, at this point, acknowledge that.
Let me just ask you, because I'm also curious about your thoughts, whatever you have to say about among the serving military, and not just perhaps people who are in the leadership positions, but among serving military down through the ranks, what people think. I've just came across a story about a recent survey that was done by Military Times. This was a survey of 3,000 active duty troops. And while they found that opposition to gay men and women serving openly has fallen, there's still 51% seem to be opposed. And this was a survey that was published by the Military Times Group. They also, according to the survey, found less than a third of active duty personnel, 30%, favored allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly. So there we've got 70% who apparently think that the ban on open service should stand.
Uh, I don't think it's 70%. I'm not sure that it was correct to add those two numbers together. But certainly we have seen that kind of resistance. Did you see the poll of enlisted people asking them whether they felt like invading Iraq?
No.
No, because there wasn't one.
There wasn't one.
So that's not how we've ever made policy, except when it comes to gays and lesbians, where we decide to ask the majority whether they feel like granting rights to the minority. That's just not the way we do things. It's also not the relevant question. By all means, I agree that it's important to consult the troops. I think there are anxieties and concerns. They are fighting on the front lines, and they deserve to be consulted and not just dismissed. So I'm not trying to do that. But the relevant question is not what do you feel like, because the military is not about what one group of people wants. It's not about individual desire. People don't choose who they can serve with, except when it comes to gays, according to people who want to rely on these polls alone. The relevant question isn't do you wish to serve with gays or Jews or blacks or women. It's are you capable of it? And three-quarters of service members say that they're personally comfortable around gays. And as I've said, two-thirds already know they're serving with gays, and the other third are kidding themselves if they truly think that they have never been showering or sharing a barrack with a gay person.
We are a bit past our midpoint here. I have two other callers we will get right to, but first let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Nathaniel Frank. He's a senior research fellow at the Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara. The center has been around since 1998. They do research on issues of gender, sexuality, and the military. He's done a lot of interviews on this subject. He has written for various publications. His writing has appeared in various publications, New York Times, Washington Post, New Republic, LA Times, among others. He's also the author of the book Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. That book was published in March of last year by St. Martin's Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Two ready to go. They're both in Champaign. We'll start with line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to say to your previous caller, shame on you. This is ridiculous. We don't always do things, as your guest says, because everybody's ready for it. A lot of times we do things because they are the right things to do. We had the same problem when we were integrating. We have the same problem when women were you know, being challenged as not being capable and the men wouldn't trust them if they had to fight alongside them. We have reached the point now where this, I think it's an insult to people who serve in the military to suggest that they cannot, if they're asked to, step up to the bar and serve the way they're supposed to serve, and that it's just ridiculous. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know. Any Dr. Frank, you want to comment on that anyway? Or you needn't. We can go on to another caller.
And as I say, I think it's one thing to consult the troops about how we can do this most smoothly. And, you know, Secretary Gates is talking about that. They have this 11-month study period. I have raised concerns about it because it's during the so-called study period in 1993 when Clinton was waffling about whether to do this that his plans for reform were derailed because it gives an opportunity for obstructionists to obstruct. And, in fact, the research from the RAND Corporation itself, which the Secretary of Defense has asked to update their research, says that when you do a policy like this, you should do it quickly and simply and swiftly so that you don't leave a lot of confusion and anxiety and room for obstructionists. So I think it's important to consult the troops about what they're going to need in order to make this smooth, but not to ask their permission. And in that sense, I agree with the caller.
All right. Let's go to line number two. This is also a Champaign caller. Hello.
Yes, I'm just coming in on the conversation, but I'm fairly certain that analogies have been made to the time when President Truman, by executive order, I think 1981, eliminated segregation and discrimination in the military for African Americans. And you know what surprised me when this debate was simmering around when President Clinton was ready to do this is how the chief military officer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, an African American, seemed to oppose eliminating the ban on gay and lesbian people serving in the armed forces in the face of him knowing how this had been used with the same justifications, all of which turned out to be unfounded with African-Americans that were being used and still are being used with respect to gays serving in the military. I'd like to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I think that's exactly right. There are analogies to be drawn between the situation of racial integration and lifting the ban. They're not perfect. There are differences. But what Colin Powell said in an angry speech in 1993 was that there are important differences between racial integration and sexual orientation. And as I've written in my book, some of the senior officers who were at the table discussing this subsequently told me that Colin Powell's stature as an African-American, you know, the top general in the military, helped shut people up, you know, that basically they could say, this is different. Racial integration is different, and Colin Powell says so. So end of discussion. That was not really a way of opening up discussion, and the caller's absolutely right. This same exact language, the same fears of disease and molestation and trust and privacy and intimacy, identical language was used to oppose racial integration. And it turned out, you know, that those fears were unfounded. And in fact, there were greater problems with racial integration and with women in combat than there have been and will be with gays in the military. You know, as late as the 1970s, there were race riots on U.S. Navy ships. So that did take some time. In this case, one of the differences is that gays are already there. We're not talking about actually integrating new groups of people. We're talking about simply admitting and allowing honesty among those who are already serving together.
One follow-up, if I might, David. It'll be quick.
Sure.
As I study this issue, Truman's policy of eliminating discrimination against African Americans by executive order wasn't readily received by the powers of be in the Army and especially the Navy. So when the barriers did officially, in fact, drop, it was not a matter of per se of policy demanded by President Truman in his executive order, but a matter of military necessity with the Korean War. My question to you is that as a matter of military necessity in Iraq and Afghanistan, and especially with respect to a number of Arabic gay people that have been released, why not have this ban more tolerant or flexible in light of military necessity?
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening, and these changes in the positions of the top military leadership reflect that, and sociologists have been saying that for a while, that just what the caller says, that this was an issue of military necessity for racial integration. That's what finally dragged it over the finish line. And likewise here, if there had been no 9/11 and we were not at war, we probably would not be having this discussion now. But I think that's part of what the president and the senior military leadership are now conveying, that we simply can't afford to continue with a failed policy that discharges people we badly need for no good reason.
Does it hurt the cause when, as a matter of political expedience, a decorated veteran POW like John McCain all of a sudden changes his tune when Admiral Mullins and Secretary Gates say they do believe this policy should be abolished?
Well, we've known for a long time that there would be people on the right wing who try to obstruct anything that offers equal treatment to gay people. And John McCain, I'm sorry to say, is not exempt from that, even though he once portrayed himself as a much more reasonable person. I think John McCain's actions at this point are fairly transparent to most of us. He's facing a difficult reelection bid with a primary challenger from the right wing. And although he said very clearly on several occasions that as soon as the military came to him and said it was time to change this, he would seriously consider doing that. Even though he said that, he's now become angry and dug his heels in the face of evidence to the contrary. He continues to say that this failed policy works and that it shouldn't be changed now.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And just for the record, I guess we should say that now that the subject has come up again, it's being discussed again. Now Colin Powell has said that he favors lifting the ban. At least I believe that that's true.
That's right. That's right. That's an important point, yeah. And so has Dick Cheney, who was defense secretary just before Clinton's election in the first Bush era.
Mm-hmm. What I believe that either Admiral Mullen or Secretary Gates said when they made their comments a couple of weeks ago, that they had set up some kind of study panel or study commission within the Pentagon to look at this issue, and that perhaps then more a stronger recommendation might be coming to the Congress about what they should do about this policy. And they also talked about the fact that it would take some time to, if the decision was made to lift the ban, it would take some time for that to be fully implemented. And you said that, in fact, some of the people who have looked at this said, no, that's really not the way to do it. You shouldn't take your time. You should just do it. And right. then obviously, there are probably a number of questions that will have to be worked out. I suppose that I did find myself wondering, well, you know, they're talking about the fact that it wouldn't be fully implemented until maybe as far out as 2012, and what it is they think they need to do before it actually can happen.
Well, and it's not just anyone who has said that implementation should go into effect quickly. It's the RAND Corporation, which is an independent think tank created by the Air Force after World War II with close ties to the military, and is the group that issued a 500-page study paid for by us taxpayers back in 1993 when then-Secretary of Defense Les Aspin commissioned the exact same two groups to study this issue, which was the RAND Corporation on the one hand and an appointed military working group on the other hand. So it's rather eerie that the script is exactly the same as in 1993 when reform failed. The world and the context has changed enormously, and we now have a sitting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying we should lift this ban, and we have a lot more research to show that that's wise. But it is a concern that the RAND Corporation, which Secretary Gates has asked for an update, has already recommended lifting the ban 17 years ago, and that was ignored. So what are they going to say this time when they update it? Lift it faster, you dummy?
Let's go to another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. We seem to have a double standard for behavior of people who are gay and people who are heterosexual. It's common knowledge that in many places around the world where there are U.S. bases, that there are prostitution houses. You know, prostitutes are really quite common. And I keep hearing about instances where male armed service members have raped somebody who is local. I don't want somebody to say women should not serve in the armed services because that's what causes men to behave badly, and that's why you have rapes. In response to the caller from Bloomington, Indiana, it seems to me that any abuse of power, which is what forced sexual relations involves, can come in other forms. And when a leader abuses his power or her power, then they lose the trust of their of the people under them. And it doesn't have to be sexual. It can be more devastating if it's more pervasive, it seems to me. You know, in my lifetime, I was just counting it up while I was standing here, four friends who were married women, had been married, came out as being lesbians. And I had no clue. I was honored that they were able to trust me and a few others that as to who they actually were, but they couldn't trust everybody. And they're much happier people. Those people who think that gays aren't all around them, gays and lesbians and bisexual and transgendered, are not paying attention and may very well have set up barriers so that they cannot be told safely.
I think that's well put, and that a lot of the resistance to lifting this ban is based on fear, and it's a fear that's not well thought out because, you know, time to replace fear with facts and with facing the reality that gays are already in the military. So the idea that somehow keeping this ban in place can keep you safer from these fears of a gay bogeyman that's going to abuse power are unfounded. This is not to say that everybody will behave perfectly, but certainly the evidence is that straight abuse of power is widespread. and the military does its best to keep that in line, and the same will apply for gay people, and that, you know, they're already there, so keeping it underground does not do anyone a service.
Well, again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Nathaniel Frank. He is a senior research fellow at the Palm Center at University of California, Santa Barbara, and is the author of the book Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America, published last March by St. Martin's Press. This is now an issue we're discussing now, and it was an issue 17 years ago when we got the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. That might make it seem as if the issue of gays in the military was something that was an issue pretty much over the last few decades. And I think we have reason to believe that probably there have always been some gay people serving in the military. How long has this really been a matter of formal debate or open debate? Or, in fact, has it not really been a matter of open debate, but it was something that people talked about going back to early America?
Well, the ban on gays in the military in some form, or I should say on homosexual conduct in the military, because it wasn't always a ban that singled out gay people, has a long history. But as with issues of gays and lesbians generally, the culture didn't talk about this very openly until the last generation or two. It wasn't considered polite. As more and more people came out, and more people came to realize that gays were just like you and me, and that they were, you know, your family, friends, and coworkers, this became an issue that seemed like common sense to, you know, to likewise begin to get rid of the closet in the military. And the military culture, as a tradition-bound culture, sort of dug in its heels, and then the cultural and political leaders who represent those constituencies also dug in their heels. So at various points throughout the 20th century, and I go through this in my book in the first chapter, there were discussions about this. And initially, gays and lesbians weren't even mentioned, and even homosexuality wasn't mentioned. It was all kind of euphemisms and codes about unnatural carnal behavior. But in fact, that's telling, because the ban actually targeted not just gay people, but any kind of sexual activity that wasn't missionary-style married, you know, very straight behavior, and gays kind of got caught up in that. But it was mostly the late 20th century when this was discussed in earnest, and we're now seeing a repeat of some of those debates, and it's possible that this will be the last one.
Mm-hmm. How much of an issue do you think will, for the military, social relations between gay people be in the sense, I think there are some people are saying, well, now we're going to have to think about things like what happens if we have two service members who are married? Are we going to allow them to live together on the base? If they were married in a state where gay marriage is legal and then they're moved to some place where it's not, what does that mean for their relationship? You know, are we going to say to gay service members that you can bring your, and we're having a military social event, mm-hmm. we're going to say to them, it's cool if you bring your partner. That seemed to me some rather practical and potentially difficult things that would have to be worked out. Is that something that they'll have to be a formal policy on?
Well, there are some practical questions that need to be answered, but they're actually not as difficult as most people think. And in fact, almost all of them have been answered. The Palm Center has put out plenty of research on the so-called thorny questions that Sam Nunn used to try to delay this in 1993 to act like it was much more delicate and sensitive and complicated than it is. We're not talking about health care or the stimulus. We're talking about ceasing to fire people because they're gay. And some of the questions you ask are already answered because the Federal Defense of Marriage Act in the U.S. bans the federal government or any of its agencies from recognizing a same-sex marriage, even if a state allows it. So that's actually a non-issue. You know, down the road, as the Defense of Marriage Act may be repealed, then gay people may be treated just like straight people. But there's really no issue there. The military is not the one who decides in this country what a family is. The government does that in conjunction with the culture. And for the moment, they've decided that gay couples are not to be recognized, and the military will have to follow that.
One more caller, at least. Someone in Chicago. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. When Harry Truman decided to integrate the Army, Did he take a year studying the effects?
He didn't. He actually exercised leadership. He issued an executive order. However, the order did not take effect immediately. It did take some time. It was phased in certain ways, and the research, you know, building on that, found that that actually was not a good idea. So historically, to answer your question factually, he didn't study it when he made the decision, but the implementation was dragged out, and it wasn't a good idea. So the lesson from that is, you know, be decisive, and I think that's what Admiral Mullen showed the country earlier this month. And when he was accused of command influence, he said to a senator, this is not about command influence, it's about leadership, and I take that very seriously.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. That was an interesting point, and I don't know if we have time to explore it thoroughly, why that was such an important thing. And perhaps for people who are not in the military, they don't know exactly what that means. I'm not exactly sure what that means myself. This point of was the admiral, would he be exercising undue influence as a result of his position of authority to get people to do something that they wouldn't ordinarily want to do or shouldn't be asked to do?
And of course not. That's why everybody was saying that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who is the top uniformed official in the country, should weigh in with his opinion, and that's exactly what he did. And then the people on the far right who are going to block gay equality at any cost started to bark at him. It is true that the individual service chiefs, as well as the chairman, are obligated to and ought to give the president and the country their best advice on military matters. And so we're going to hear from the service chiefs, I believe, next week. But, you know, since they are mandated to give their opinion, these service chiefs, unlike enlisted personnel, don't have any concern, shouldn't have any concern about whether they can express their opinion, and we will hear their opinion. So everyone's opinion, you know, among the joint chiefs needs to be heard.
So we have about a minute. What in the near term here, how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, it looks to me like the Defense Department may relax enforcement, which has always been the beginning of the end in the other countries where this has happened. And that they have latitude to do that, and Gates is supposed to announce ways that they plan to do that next month. Then we have a battle in Congress at some point, and it's just unclear whether in this political climate that will be taken up this year or be put off for a few years.
All right. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Dr. Nathaniel Frank. He's a senior research fellow at the Palm Center at University of California, Santa Barbara, where they do research on issues of gender, sexuality, and the military. They do have a website if you'd like to find out more about what they do and about this subject. Also, you might want to read the book that Dr. Frank authored. It's titled Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America, published in March 2009 by St. Martin's Press. And Dr. Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
WILO programs are made possible by the Bevere Cafe. The Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. WILO thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. A little later today, Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine will be talking with oceanographer and National Geographic Explorer in Residence Sylvia Earle. They'll be talking about the oceans and why the health of the oceans matter so much. She is the author of the book The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. That's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. Right now, we're going to break for an update on the markets and news. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
We'll take a look at the commodity markets at about a minute before 11 o'clock Central. We see March wheat in Kansas City at 513, up 18 and a half. May is at 524 and a quarter, up 18 and a half. And July at 534 and a half, up 17 and a half. March wheat in Chicago, 505 and three quarters, up 19 and a quarter now. May at 520 and a quarter, up 19. And July at 532 and three quarters, up 18 and three quarters. March corn, 367, up 5.5. May at 378 and a quarter, up 5. July at 389 and a half, up 5.25. September, 396, up 4.75. December at 402, up 4.5. The March soybeans at 962 and a quarter, up 17 and a quarter. May at 971, up 17. July at 978, up 17 and a quarter. And the August beans are at 972¾, up 16¾. September, 954, up 16½. And November, 938, up 16. The March soybean meal, 283.10, up 3.10. May also up 3.10 at 277.30. March oil, 38.87, up 103. May is up 101 at 39.